Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. The producers for the show, Jack Brighton, Harriet Williamson, Brian Wagner at the controls today. Tomorrow morning on the show, in the first part of the program, we'll be talking with Isaiah Barnwell. She is a composer, a vocalist, instrumentalist. She is one member of the vocal group Sweet Honey in the Rock. She was here visiting the campus early this spring. She was going to be on the show, and I got sick, and we had to postpone the program, but she was good enough to say she would talk with us by telephone. Not quite as nice as having her in the studio, but good nonetheless. So we'll be talking a little bit with her about her music tomorrow in the first part of the show. Hour two, the guest is Michael Wood. He is a British author, journalist, documentary filmmaker. We'll be talking about his book, Conquistadors, which is a companion to a PBS series that is airing this month on many public television stations, including ours, WILL-TV. There are four segments to this series, and we will have the first two on WILL-TV tomorrow night, and then on the 16th, we'll have parts 3 and 4. So you will have the opportunity to see it. If you're also interested in the book, you can check that out. And we'll be talking about the book and the series with Mike Wood tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour of Focus 580. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. Always give you the chance to call in and ask questions. We also are on the web 24 hours a day. You can listen through your computer in real time, if that works out better for you. Also, we have archives of interviews from Focus 580, Afternoon Magazine. We have news features there. Our Commodity Week program is there. Many of the programs we air for you to listen to anytime you like. It's all at WILL.UIUC.EDU. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the relationship between China and the United States. And our guest for the program is David Lampton. He is professor and director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He's also director of Chinese Studies at the Nixon Center in Washington, D.C. He's been following Chinese politics for many years, has also written widely on the topic. His most recent book is titled Same Bed, Different Dreams, Managing U.S.-China Relations in the Period from 1989 to 2000. The book is published by the University of California Press, and the title comes from a Chinese expression that describes the relationship of two people whose lives are intimately intertwined, but fundamentally who just don't communicate. And that certainly seems to be an apt description of the relationship between China and the United States, two countries that's whose fates are fundamentally intertwined, except often do not communicate very well with each other for a number of reasons that we will discuss this morning as we talk with David Lampton. As we talk, as always, questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in, you can do that, be a part of the conversation. All we ask is people just be brief so we can get in as many people as possible and keep things moving along. But anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Also, would like to mention that we have an extra copy of the book, Same Bed, Different Dreams. We'd like to find a home for it. We will give it away at about midway through the show. What we'll do is give you a phone number to call, and the first person in will get the book. And don't worry, we won't give your name on the air or anything like that. We just have a copy, and we'd like somebody to have it. And later on, I will tell you the number for you to call. Professor Lampton, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Good to be with you.
We appreciate it. I took a look at an essay that you wrote, which was your short bit of advice to President Bush. And it was written, I think, actually before the Bush administration really got going. So this was your, if the president had asked you, well, what do you think? And it of course, predated the issue of the spy plane. Mm-hmm. How would you suggest he proceed? And it's very, I think it much reflects the kind of advice that you also offer in the book in terms of policy. And I wonder, you know, given the fact that you say in here that consistency is very important, a mistake that you think that perhaps early on Mr. Clinton made, that this, certainly the administration should speak with one voice. I wonder what you think about how the Bush administration has done, not just through the spy plane incident, but also more recently when it seemed that some of the president's comments on Taiwan were... He had to actually do spin control on himself because he said some things and then later said, no, what I really meant was. And then we had the stuff with Mr. Rumsfeld saying one thing and then the White House saying, no, that's really not right. And that certainly seemed to be some difficulty puzzling out. And I'm sure it was even harder if you were on the Chinese side, puzzling out just exactly what the policy of the administration is. So how have they done so far?
Well, I think, one, you need to have a little understanding and sympathy. It's tough to be president of the United States. You have to appoint several thousand people almost immediately. And one of the problems they have is they don't even have all of their people in the policy slots that are relevant to making China policy. So I think the first thing to say is we need to be a little understanding. Having said that, I think the record is mixed. Maybe a little... historical perspective would be useful. The five administrations preceding Mr. Bush each have had various degrees of difficulty in their transition with China. President Reagan had about a year and a half problem. President Clinton, when he came in his first term, had about a 3.5 year problem. So we're almost becoming to expect that that difficult transitions are the norm. So before I deliver any criticisms, it's good to say others have had problems, first of all, and it's not easy. Having said all that, I think his record is mixed at this point. I think on the spy plane incident or the reconnaissance plane incident, I would say that the first 2 days were not well handled by the administration. They didn't make it clear what their priorities were. They came out and demanded the plane back without saying that they were sorry a Chinese pilot had been killed, and sort of the tone of it got the Chinese back up, and of course they came back with their unreasonable demands, and so we really took 11 days to sort out the initial statements. I think a lesson emerges from this, and that is in any crisis, the first few hours and the first few sentences said by each side set a pattern. Once the crisis or the incident passed the first 2 or 3 days, I think both sides handled it about as well as it could be handled, sent consistent messages for the most part, particularly the Bush administration. So I think they did all right then. Then we get into these other statements that the president made with respect to Taiwan and then the Department of Defense with respect to whether or not military-to-military exchanges would continue with China. And here we may partly be seeing an inexperienced staff at work, particularly in the Defense Department, didn't have all the people in place. But the long and the short of it is I think the Chinese are probably fairly confused about our policy in the first case, but I think they see a trend now. I just returned from Taiwan and Hong Kong, and I should say people in the region are somewhat alarmed. They don't want the United States to have highly tense relations with China if it's avoidable. And I think we're worrying our friends in Japan and Taiwan even, and certainly in Hong Kong. So I hope the administration settles in and also acts to reassure our allies.
I think that there has been some criticism of the Bush Asia policy in this respect. People said that we were tilting towards Japan. That's where we thought that relationship was very important, and so we had some people who knew something about Japan, but that the administration didn't have very many people, or maybe they didn't have anybody who really knew about China. And in fact, we were very lucky in that our ambassador there was a holdover from the Clinton years and did know something about China. He had some experience there. And that perhaps part of the reaction of the Chinese to this whole business with the plane was that the Chinese were trying to bring home to the United States that China matters and that they're not going to be treated, they're not going to be brushed aside, they're not going to be treated that lightly.
I think you've hit the nail on the head, and the way I put it some time ago is the administration may wish to downgrade China, but China's not going to allow itself to be downgraded. Mm-hmm. It's just too important, has too many interests. It'll present too many problems to the United States. And so if you ask in President Bush's first 100 days what country did he spend the most time on in foreign policy, my guess is that China's at the head of that list, possibly the Middle East and then China, but certainly China's probably at the top of that list. I should say, too, you're very correct in saying that the initial objective of the administration was to elevate the importance we attach to our allies in the region, in particular Japan. And I think what concerns at least people like me would be that I would agree that we ought to attach importance to our allies, but that has to be more than a rhetorical assertion. The Japanese have just elected a new prime minister, and they have a new foreign minister, Tanaka. I think they are both worried that the United States would have too much friction in its relationship with China. Japan, after all, has a security alliance with us, and if we end up in a scrape with the People's Republic of China over Taiwan or anything else, that forces the Japanese into a very uncomfortable position. And similarly, certainly South Korea, the Republic of Korea, is a major ally of the United States. And when Kim Dae-jung, their president, came not long ago to Washington, he felt rebuffed. So I think we've got two problems here. We're getting all the disadvantage of telling China we're going to downgrade it, and we're not getting any of the advantages of making our allies happy.
Mm. Well, and I think that people probably have now got maybe a little bit better feeling about how the Chinese think of themselves and what their place in the world should be. I think often when we look at China, we say, yes, it's an enormous country. It is an enormous market, so the potential for doing business with the Chinese is significant. And at the same time, we see it as being while it is a very large country, still a developing nation. The Chinese, from their point of view, say, you know, we were a great civilization a long, long time ago when the rest of the world were howling barbarians, and we think that we are still a very important nation, a very important actor on the world stage, and expect some respect along those lines. And whether or not we think that's the case, it's probably important for us to remember that the Chinese think that that's the case, and that should inform our relationship with them.
I think you're very right. China, and in my book, I talk at some length that has a very interesting and very important history in modern times, certainly since the 1840s. And to summarize a very complicated history simply, I think China comes out of that history, 1840 to certainly 1949, feeling that it's a victim nation. And in fact, frequently the Chinese talk about their victimhood, the more than 100 years of what they call national humiliation. And it's no accident that I think Mao Zedong, in his first post-49 speech on the founding of the People's Republic of China, entitled his speech, "The Chinese People Have Stood Up." And if the communists won the revolution for any particular reason, it was that the communists had thrown the foreigners out and reunified China and stopped this, what was generally perceived as humiliation. And you can see, even in events like the tragic bombing of the Chinese embassy in Yugoslavia, that while students and intellectuals may be very unhappy with the Chinese government in many respects, when they stand up against foreigners, you find that suddenly the communist government in Beijing has the support of the Chinese people. And indeed, in some cases, the Chinese government fosters this nationalism because it's one of the few support bases that it has. So I think one of the things that makes it so difficult for a basically self-confident country like the United States is to deal with a country that's, on the one hand, believes it has a proud history and almost a right to be consulted in most decisions for Asia, and on the other hand, more recent times has been treated as a second-class citizen and sees itself as having been exploited. And so there's this kind of schizoid quality, the Chinese wanting to interact with the world as an equal and yet behaving very defensively. I think also the Chinese have a growing interest in the region, too. One of the things is that their economy has been growing very rapidly, and much of it's been located along the coast. And while Mao Zedong planned the national defense of China to be a war fought on Chinese territory, then the people that came after Mao, Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin, have pushed the military perimeter off the shore and are developing Navy and Air Force capabilities. And, of course, their view is they're defending their increasing gross national product that's along the coast. But as they acquire this naval and Air Force capability to defend themselves, in their view, automatically China's smaller neighbors, Taiwan, Japan, begin to feel threatened. And so what you find is China, for very good reasons, is modernizing its defense and acquiring new offshore capabilities, and this is threatening a lot of the neighbors, and the United States is reacting as well. So it's both a complicated psychological situation we're dealing with and a very complicated security situation.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, David Lampton. He is Director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and has written a great deal about Chinese politics and this relationship between China and the United States. His most recent book is titled Same Bed, Different Dreams. It looks at U.S.-China relations in the period between 1989 and 2000. It's published by the University of California Press. We have a caller, and others are welcome if you have questions. 333-9455, that's for Champaign Urbana callers. But anybody else, if it would be long distance call, use the number 800-222-9455. Let's talk with our first caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi, David.
Yes.
Yes.
Hi, Professor Lampton. Great pleasure.
Thank you.
I only had a chance to read your short letter to President and your chapter 8 of your book.
Uh-huh.
I didn't realize books on international politics could be such a page-turner.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And I just wonder if you had heard anything from President Bush or his office.
No, he's been busy with other things, I guess, here. But I think many of the people around him are very, thoughtful people that will try to manage this relationship. But it's not going to be easy, and no matter who was president would have some difficulties here.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have so many questions, but I'll just put a couple out there, and you can choose to answer one or none. Anything
okay.
Will be good. And one is, I want to hear your idea of American interest, especially relating to Asian countries, China, and especially both in short term, in long term, and how's American interest intersect with the interest of people in Asia, or even say the interest of humanity, if there are such
mm-hmm.
things. And another thing is, there's so many interesting characters in your book, and every one of them deserves a book. You can probably write a book on every one of them. But I like to maybe want you to talk about Jiang Zemin.
Uh-huh.
And he outwardly seemed to be a rather sort of a bumbly sort of person and reminiscent of another Chinese leader, Hu Yaobang. But he probably have much greater depths than he appeared. Also, you talk about his friendship with Wang Daohan, and those are very interesting relationships. And the third one, sort of just a comment, and the title, I think, is very telling, and it's on the one hand suggesting the intimate relationship between countries, and also make me feel rather sort of a despondent, considering the divorce rate and the fierce fighting between couples sometime. And if we can't even work out between individuals, what is the hope of working things out between the countries?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I think one of the principal points in my book is that no one should make the mistake of underestimating the interests that the United States has in its relationship with China, and incidentally, the interest that China has in its relations with us. While China may seem exotic to many people, nonetheless, it bears on our interests in a number of ways. First of all, if you look at past history, the world system hasn't been very good in absorbing new rising rapid powers, and I don't mean to equate China with Japan or Germany of the 1930s, but in the sense that what we have here is 22% of the people of the world are modernizing very rapidly at 8% to 9% rate of growth over the last 15 years. And the world system, the status quo powers, the United States, Europe, Japan, don't necessarily accommodate the demands of a new rising power that easily. So certainly the biggest single interest, in my view, would be a security interest, and that is coming up with an architecture that integrates China in a peaceful way, gives China a role as its people deserve in the making of the rules of both the region and the world, and yet manage some of the potential downsides of China's growth. So we have a security interest in managing this relationship well. Certainly, we have an economic interest, and many of our biggest multinational corporations look at the question of whether they are going to be competitive in the latter part of this 21st century. And what all these firms are going to need is scale of production. And if we don't have our tentacles, so to speak, into the Chinese market as it rapidly grows and modernizes, as I believe it will, and it's building a middle class with a middle class consumption pattern, then our firms are not going to be as competitive as Japanese and Europeans that may have better access. So we certainly, and also China has such a talented, both hardworking but also intellectually talented and innovative population that we need to be able to draw on that talent just as others will as well. And certainly we have an interest in the humane governance of China because, frankly, if China falls apart or is a human rights tragedy, it's going to spew unhappy refugees into the world system. And just think how difficult it was for the world system to deal with the much smaller refugee populations of Cambodia and Vietnam. And as I say, China's 22% of the world's people. It could just create untold numbers of unhappy refugees if that situation weren't to be humanely and well managed. So I think we have enormous interests, and people who talk about the collapse of China as though that would be a good thing, while it's certainly true that we don't admire the communist and authoritarian political system, the fact of the matter is it's very important that China remain minimally stable and it be able to feed, house, and clothe its people. And that wouldn't be an easy job for any kind of government. And so at the same time, we try to nudge things in a more humane and rule-based, law-based direction. I think we also shouldn't push things so far so fast that we contribute to total social breakdown. That shouldn't be our objective either. You also asked an interesting question about Jiang Zemin, and I won't go on too long about him, but he is a very interesting figure, and I think he's also generally underestimated in the West. He projects a kind of jovial, not always serious kind of exterior to Americans on first glance, but this is a guy who now is the longest reigning leader of a major country probably in the world today. I think he's been in power longer than Margaret Thatcher was at the point where she retired. And so survival when you're at the top of a billion-plus political system is no small thing. He also survived a patron, Deng Xiaoping, before him, who had sacked a couple of his predecessors, and Jiang Zemin was able to make the old man happy and stay in power there. So that's certainly also under Jiang Zemin, China's had a growth rate of around 9% per year, which is nothing to sneeze at when you're talking about 22% of the world's people. He is a balancer. I often speak of him somewhat, not in all regards equal, but sort of the Bill Clinton of Chinese politics, in the sense that what he's searching for is that middle ground. He's not an ideologue. Sometimes it's even hard to specify all of his deep commitments on principle, but he usually finds that middle ground that allows him and the system to move forward. He's kind of a political balancer. So I think people tend to underestimate him. I think he's taken China a long way. The big failing, I would say, is that he's been afraid, for good reasons, to tackle political reform. And ultimately, I think the problems that lie ahead for the Chinese political system are in the zone of lack of political reform and increasing demands from a rising middle class. So there's much to, I think, admire in a technical sense of Jiang Zemin's rule in the past, but he's leaving real big problems for his successors.
We are at our midpoint here. Again, our guest for the program is David Lampton. He is somebody who's been following Chinese politics for a long time and has written a great deal on China and the relationship between China and the U.S. He is director of China Studies at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He is also director of Chinese Studies at the Nixon Center in Washington, D.C. Back at the beginning of the program, I mentioned that we had a copy of the book, Same Bed, Different Dreams, that we would like to give away, and I will do that right now. Here is the number to call. It is 333-7300, and the first person in will get the book with our thanks. And of course, anybody who's interested in reading it can find it in the bookstore. I'm sure it's published by the University of California Press. Other folks you'd like to call in and to talk with our guest, you're welcome to do that. 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. The next caller is in Champaign, and they're on line 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a few questions that I want to bring up, and then I'll listen for responses. One of the things that you touched upon, Professor Lampton, was about the problems that, or I'll put it even stronger, the failure to abide by law, rules, and agreements that China has. And I especially point to issues such as intellectual property theft and all sorts of other behavior like that, especially industrial spying, such as the recent case with, I think it was AT&T or Lucent Technology, I'm not sure.
Lucent, yeah.
And the use of Chinese nationals abroad for spying of all sorts. That's one. The second matter has to do with the ongoing persecution and even genocide in Tibet, with the constant movement of Han population into Tibet to essentially remove the Tibetan cultural and national character, and to essentially turn Tibet into another part of China, and to fail and refuse to even deal with all sorts of good faith efforts by the Tibetan peoples, by the Dalai Lama and others, in reconciling the issues there, and the outright, I'll say genocide again, because that's what I feel it is. And the third point, which is again something you touched upon, but the ongoing corruption within the Chinese political establishment, bribes, kickbacks, and much larger, which they just had a small trial and I don't know what to call it, executions related to, but which seems to be a major problem in the Chinese society, economy. So those are three areas that I'd like to hear your responses to.
Yeah. Well, you've hit on at least three of the major, and there are more problems, but you certainly hit on them. And I would just say that while I'll try and answer them as best I can here, the book does deal with, certainly there's a lot on intellectual property and China's adherence to various international agreements and so forth. I would say on adherence to laws and agreements, and I'll talk about IPR, intellectual property, in a minute. But basically, I think China has done pretty well in comparative terms, living up to its economic agreements. It's done less well in living up to its agreements in the area of arms control and technology transfer. And it's done least well, which is to say not very well at all, in living up to its human rights agreements. So I would say, in general, China's record of living up to agreements is mixed, best in the economic area, though not perfect, and worse in the human rights area, and kind of middle of the road in arms control areas. So that's a sort of an overview. I have a lot on intellectual property, and you may be amused. I got a call from a friend in China who was saying that my book had been printed there. It was an unauthorized edition, I should say, but he tried to reassure me by saying it was selling very well, even though no agreement to have it translated or printed had been reached at all. So IPR is still a huge problem. I would say it's an interesting problem, not only when you look at why China has difficulty enforcing its intellectual property agreements, but it also frequently, much of the IPR violation involves not only China, but Taiwan and Hong Kong. And you have some, for instance, on compact discs, Taiwan turning out some of the like laser identification numbers, exporting them and the equipment to China, where the discs themselves are made, and then they're sold, marketed, and shipped through Hong Kong often. So we're in intellectual property violations, we're talking not only about imperfect, to put it mildly, compliance in China, but we're talking about what you might almost call a greater China phenomenon. On spying, I think by its very nature, we don't quite know its magnitude, but things like the recent arrest of two people at Lucent Technologies is suggestive. About a year and a half ago, there was a report called the Cox Committee report here. I must confess, I think in general it was not as well done as it could have been, but it did point to the issue of Chinese espionage, and I'm sure it occurs. Indeed, I think many nations practice that, either overt or covert, but certainly I think we don't know its magnitude here in the United States, but it's both industrial and governmental and military in character. With respect to Tibet, you're right, the migration of Han, and I talk extensively about that in my book. Indeed, I have a picture of me and the Dalai Lama. I've met him twice, and we've talked about some of these issues. And it is having this migration of Han from the rest of China into Tibet. Some of it's encouraged by the government, and also there's a large military presence that's obviously at the behest of the government. But what's interesting or makes it more complicated is that many of the people coming from, let's say, heartland China into Tibet are not necessarily coming because they've been directed by the government. They are coming because they are in search of economic opportunity, and there are many economic opportunities in Tibet. Now, in general, Han people don't like the high altitude, 12,500 feet roughly at Lhasa, and the capital of Tibet. And there are many Han that see it as a hardship tour, and they're not. And many, most Chinese are farmers, at least the agrarian people, and in low altitude and lots of water. And in Tibet, it's very arid. And so anyway, it's not a very desirable place in many regards, but a relatively few hardy souls, but that can be a big number in China, are migrating into Tibet looking for economic opportunity. And it's kind of an irony that the liberalization of the main Chinese economy and allowing people to move around in China like they were not allowed to do under Mao Zedong has freed them up to move to Tibet. And the irony is that Tibet only, in the Tibet Autonomous Region, only has about 2 million Tibetans. And so you, even a small percentage of the Chinese people that move into Tibet could totally dilute and destroy the population and the culture, and I'm afraid that's underway. And unless the Chinese stop that, government stops that, and I see, incidentally, no sign they're going to, the prospects for Tibetan culture are not good, to put it mildly. The last thing you pointed to was corruption in the political establishment. Once again, by its very nature, we don't know how extensive it is, but if you talk to Chinese, it's the thing that they are most upset about. And in particular, in the countryside now, you find that the taxation rate is going up very severely, while the income is in general straight-lined, plateaued. And so the rural dissatisfaction with capricious levies and taxation, overt and covert, by public officials is very extensive. And if the Chinese don't watch it, they're going to have real instability in their countryside, and that's a big problem.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. I should mention also that the book we had, it's gone. We've given it away. But the book is available. It's titled Same Bed, Different Dreams, and it's published by the University of California Press. If you'd like to look at it, it is in the bookstores. And other questions, welcome. Our next person up is in Aurora, and that's line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Very informative program. Sorry I missed some of it. I just wanted to know from your expertise, what are the probabilities of the spy plane being returned to us?
Well, China can always surprise you, but I'd say it's pretty close to 100%. Now, whether it's in one pieces or 1,000 pieces in boxes, I'm more inclined to think it'll probably be in pieces and in boxes. And whether all the parts are there that were when the plane landed, also one can be dubious about it. But my guess is the Chinese have, at this point, got what they're going to get out of that plane in intelligence information. They know that all they have is a symbol that will aggravate the relationship with the United States. And I think if there's any sense in Beijing, which I believe there is, they will see that it's a liability and get rid of it.
What and how are the relationships between Taiwan and China kept? Do they have meetings together, et cetera?
Well, they off and on have had meetings since 1993, a famous meeting between Wang Daohan, the former mayor of Shanghai, and a man named Gu Zhenfu, a big entrepreneur in Taiwan, marked in 1993 the start of high-level dialogue between China, mainland, and Taiwan. Then those talks got broken off, and you may remember in the mid-90s, the Chinese fired some missiles near Taiwan in 95, 96. Those talks were stopped at that time. They were about ready to resume in 1999, and then Taiwan's president made a set of remarks that the mainland did not agree with, and therefore canceled talks that were scheduled. Those talks have not been renewed, and there is no sign, in my view, that they will be renewed anytime soon. I was just in Taiwan and in Hong Kong, and not long ago was in China with Dr. Kissinger and former Defense Secretary Perry. And it seems to me that the people in the PRC believes the current government in Taiwan, led by President Chen Shui-bian, is a very weak government, that it's so weak in Taiwan that it cannot do any, can't do much that China's worried about, nor is it strong enough to make an agreement with the mainland. And so I think the PRC now is trying to undermine the current government in Taiwan with the hopes that future elections will produce a government that will be more amenable to what the PRC wants. So long and the short of it is I think that there aren't going to be any discussions, at least official discussions, anytime soon. The PRC is trying to undermine the current government in Taiwan, hoping it'll get somebody more to his liking.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. For a long time, it was the official position of both countries, and maybe it still is the official position of both countries, that there was one China. And on each side, in the mainland and in Taiwan, they said, well, one of these days, we're, the Chinese and the mainland said, we're going to get Taiwan back. The Taiwanese said, well, we're going to take China back. And oddly enough, that uneasy standstill was better than some of the things that we've heard recently from, say, people in Taiwan who have said, look, this is silly. First of all, this notion that we're going to take the mainland back is silly, but also we're not going to be taken over by the mainland, and we really ought to be talking right out about independence, that Taiwan is a country in and of itself, which, of course, the mainland government, is not going to accept. And so what long term is there any way of saying something about what is likely to happen?
Well, I think it's not necessarily widely recognized in the United States, but if you asked yourself where in the world, geographically speaking, could the United States end up in a conflict with another nuclear power? Probably the Taiwan Straits is number one on that list, maybe the only one on this list right at the moment. So I think the first thing Americans have to recognize, this is a really dangerous problem we've got. And it's at the core of our problems with China. And it infects Chinese attitudes towards our alliance with Japan. It infects their attitudes towards the Bush administration when it sells weapons to Taiwan. Almost every issue we have in China with China has a component either in close proximity to Taiwan or in more distant relationships. So it's a really important thing. It could end up, if it isn't managed properly, we could end up in a war. So that's the first thing to say. Second thing to say is you're exactly right that if you go back to 1972 when Richard Nixon made his secret, well, his visit to China following Kissinger's 1971 secret visit, out of that 72 visit came a communique called the Shanghai Communique, and it's sort of one of the foundation pillars of our relationship with China. And in that communique, there was a phrase, and it said, Chinese on both sides of the strait believe that there is but one China, and Taiwan is a part of it. Now, all our policy since then has flown from that assumption, but what's happened on Taiwan is when that statement was made in 1972, Taiwan was under martial law. It was run essentially by mainlanders who had fled the mainland and wanted to go back and rule all of China as a one China. But what's happened since 1972 is democracy has come to Taiwan, and all of the, let us say, indigenous Taiwan people that the mainlanders took over in 1949 now have political power, and their vision is, let us say, either a highly autonomous Taiwan or, in some many cases, a bulk of the population, or at least a lot of the population, would prefer an independent Taiwan. So that as you've had democracy develop on Taiwan, the local people have begun to express their desires for autonomy and a desire not to be integrated back into the PRC. And there are good reasons for that. The per capita income on Taiwan is roughly $14,000 to $15,000, and the per capita income on the mainland is, you know, less than $1,000, even by a generous interpretation. So usually people at high income don't prefer to be merged into political systems with low per capita income, and then, of course, Taiwan's a democracy and the PRC's not. So as Taiwan has, in the view of the mainland, sort of drifted away mentally from this desire for one China and a reunification, the leaders on the mainland have viewed this as a great threat, because I think China's leaders believe that if Taiwan were able to break free, two things would happen. Then the Muslims out in the western part of China would feel empowered to break away, and these are huge areas of China. And the Tibetans, that's an area twice as big as Texas, would feel empowered to try and break away. So the first thing is that the mainland leaders don't feel able to let Taiwan go, even if they wanted to, which they don't, because it would lead to a house of cards with the rest of the country on its periphery falling apart. Also, China's leaders hesitate to let Taiwan have the kind of autonomy it would like, because basically China's revolution has been about unifying the country, and Taiwan is, after Hong Kong and Macau returned to Chinese sovereignty in the late 1990s, the last unresolved territorial reunification to yet occur is Taiwan. And China's leaders believe if they don't accomplish that task, or at least aren't on a track that could plausibly lead to reunification, they would be overthrown by the Chinese people. And they might well be right about that. So out of their own self-interest and fear of a nationalist backlash, they're pushing very hard on Taiwan. So as mainland leaders become more worried about the desire for independence on Taiwan, they push back harder. They're increasing their navy and their air force, and they're building up a missile force that they say is designed to coerce or deter Taiwan from going independent. So this militarization of the Taiwan Straits that's occurred over the last 5 years is very dangerous, and the recent weapon sales of the United States fit into a more general process of increasing weapons on both sides of the straits.
We just have about 5 minutes left. I have one more caller we want to include in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for your interesting comments, Professor Lampton.
Thank you.
I just want to ask you a little question. To what extent is it maybe reasonable to believe that there are influential circles within the U.S. current administration, maybe around Rumsfeld, who'd actually like and are planning for some kind of military conflict with China?
Well, I think we face, first of all, I should make clear my own biases, and certainly different opinions could be reasonable. First of all, I don't think Mr. Rumsfeld or anybody in a position of power and authority in the United States wants a conflict with China, because it would just be of an enormous cost and scale, and it would destabilize Asia. None of our allies would probably be with us, at least under currently foreseeable circumstances. So we'd be kind of alone, you know, operating 6,000 to 8,000 miles from our shores in an endless conflict. And so I don't think anybody's looking for that. However, we're in this what I think is a kind of unfortunate cycle here, and that is that the Chinese now have come to suspect that the purpose of the United States is to slow China's rate of growth, keep China down, and encircle it with increasingly strong alliances. And China is reacting to that, and one of its reactions is to begin to devote more attention to its military resources of all sorts. And as it does that, of course, American planners, military planners, have to look and say, okay, what's the worst possible case here? And they have to plan for the least desirable circumstance, not the best hopeful circumstance. And so we begin to, you know, boost our alliance with Japan. We begin to move more carrier assets into the Pacific, and the Chinese see that and they react. And so I think we're at the opening, but nonetheless important stages of potentially a buildup in this region. I think that's tragic. First of all, it's tragic for the Chinese people and anybody who hopes for human rights there, because China will not become more liberal politically as the military plays a bigger role there. And in the previous decade, particularly in the 80s and the 90s, China devoted a relatively small percentage of its economy to the military. My guess is, in fact, it's I think quite obvious that they're beginning to devote more of their economic wherewithal to military concerns, and that's going to, I think, retard economic growth, increase the power of the military in China, and from my point of view, that's all undesirable. So, you know, people here who think China's destined to be a strategic challenge, if we react by, you know, a more muscular policy, we're probably contributing to a self-fulfilling prophecy here. And so how we break out of this cycle and kind of try to build a little more self-confidence or mutual confidence between the two, I think, is the most pressing issue that our government faces.
And I am going to have to jump in at this point because we've reached the end of our time, and I'm sorry, there are other questions we could raise, but for the moment, we'll have to leave it at that. We want to say to you, Professor Lampton, thanks very much for talking.
I enjoyed it, and your caller's questions were great.
David Lampton, our guest, he's Director of China Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. And if you would like to read his book, once again, the title is Same Bed, Different Dreams. It looks at U.S.-China relations in the period between 1989 and 2000, and the book is published by the University of California Press.